Thanks for keeping me warm.
My fire was down to a few embers. I reached carefully for my wood and added a few sticks to the fire. It seemed as if my hands were a long way away from me. When I had the fire burning, I sat and warmed myself. Then I stood and staggered a few steps to where the snow began. I rubbed a handful across my face to cleanse it of the taste and smell of blood. I put a bit of clean snow in my mouth, for my tongue felt thick and clotted.
"Do you need to rest? Do you need food?"
Night Eyes asked me anxiously.
"Yes, and yes. But most of all, we need to flee."
I had no doubt that what I had done would bring them after me. I had done what I wanted, and beyond all my expectations. It had been real. I had given them a reason to fear me. Now, they would never rest until they'd destroyed me. I had also shown them plainly where I was. They'd have a feel for where to send their men. I must not be here when they arrived. I went back to my fire and kicked earth onto it. I stamped it to be sure it was out. Then we fled. We traveled as swiftly as I could manage. There was no question that I held Night Eyes back. He would look at me pityingly as I toiled up a hill, hip deep in snow, that he but spread toes and ran lightly over. It was not unusual that when I begged for a rest and stopped to lean against a tree, he would range ahead, searching out the best trail. When both light and my strength were near exhausted, and I would stop to build a fire for the night, he would disappear and return with meat for both of us. Most often it was white snow hares, but once it was a fat beaver that had ventured too far from its iced-over pond. I made pretense to myself that I cooked my meat, but it was a very brief searing over a fire. I was too tired and too hungry to do more. The meat diet put no fat on my flesh, but it did keep me alive and moving. I had little of true sleep, for I had to constantly replenish my fire to keep from freezing and rise several times a night to stamp feeling back into my feet. Endurance. That was what it was all about. Not swiftness or great strength, but a miserly eking out of my ability to force myself to keep moving every day. I kept my skill walls up tight, but even so I was aware of Will's battling against them. I did not think he could track me as long as I guarded myself. But I was not certain of that. The constant mental wariness was yet another draw on my strength. Some nights I longed simply to drop all my guards and let him in, to finish me off, once and for all. But at such times all I had to do was recall what Regal was now capable of doing. Without fail, it put a bolt of terror through me and inspired me to push myself all the harder to increase the distance between us. When I arose on the fourth dawn of our travelling, I knew we were deep within the Mountain Kingdom. I had seen no sign of pursuit since we had left Moon's Eye. Surely this deep within Ketrigan's own land we were safe.
"How much farther is this, Jumpe? And what shall we do when we get there?"
"I don't know how much farther, and I don't know what we shall do." For the first time, I considered it. I forced myself to think of all that I had not permitted myself to consider before. I knew nothing truly of what had become of Ketrigan since the time I had sent her from the king's side to flee into the night. She had had no word from me, or about me. Ketrigan would have borne the child by now. By my reckoning, her babe would be close in age to my own daughter. I suddenly found myself very curious. I could hold that babe and say to myself, "This must be how it feels to hold my daughter." Except that Ketrigan believed me dead. Executed by Regal and long buried would be what she had heard. She was my queen and Verity's wife. Surely I could reveal to her how I had survived. But to tell the truth to her would be like dropping a pebble in a pond. Unlike Starling or Kettle, or anyone else who had deduced who I was, Ketrigan had known me before. It would not be rumor or legend, not a wild tale of someone who had glimpsed me for a moment, but a fact. She could say to others who had known me, "Yes, I saw him, and he truly lives." How? Why, by his wit, of course. I trudged along behind Night Eyes through the snow and cold and thought, what would that mean to Patience when word reached her? Shame or joy? Hurt that I had not revealed myself to her? Through Ketrickin, word could be sent to spread to those I had known. Eventually, it would reach Molly and Burridge. What would it do to Molly to hear it from afar like that? Not only that I was alive and had not returned to her, but that I was tainted with the wit. It had cut me to the heart to know she had kept from me the knowledge that she carried our child. That had been my first true glimpse of how betrayed and hurt she must have felt by all the secrets I had kept from her over the years. To have one more and one of such magnitude pushed in her face might end whatever feeling she might still have for me. My chances of rebuilding a life with her were small enough. I could not bear for them to dwindle further. And all the others, the stable folk I had known, the men I had rode and fought alongside, the common soldiers of Buckkeep would find out as well. However I might feel about the wit, I had already seen the disgust in one friend's eyes. I had seen how it had changed even Starling's attitude toward me. What would folk think of Burridge, that he had had a witted one in his stable and tolerated me? Would he be discovered as well? I gritted my teeth. I would have to remain dead. Better, perhaps, to bypass Jompei altogether, and press on to find Verity, save that, without supplies. I had as much chance of that as Night Eyes had of passing himself off as a lapdog. And there was one other small matter. The map. When Verity had departed Buckkeep, it had been on the strength of a map. It was an old one that Ketrickin had unearthed in the Buckkeep libraries. It had been faded and ancient, made in the days of King Wisdom, who had first visited the Elderlings and enlisted them to the aid of the six duchies. The detail of the map had faded, but both Ketrickin and Verity had been convinced that one of the marked trails led to where King Wisdom had first encountered these elusive beings. Verity had left Buckkeep, determined to follow the map into the regions beyond the Mountain Kingdom. He had taken with him the fresh copy of the map he had made. I had no idea what had become of the older map. Probably carried off to Tradeford, where Regal had looted Buckkeep's libraries. But the style of the map, and the unusual characteristics of the bordering, had made me long suspect that the map was a copy of yet an older map. The bordering was in the mountain style. If the original were to be found anywhere, it would be in the libraries of Jompei. I had had some access to them in the months of my convalescence in the mountains. I knew their library was both extensive and well kept. Even if I did not find the original of that particular map, I might perhaps find others that covered the same area. During my time in the mountains, I had also been impressed with what a trusting folk they were. I had seen few locks and no guards, such as we had at Buckkeep. It would be no trick to get into the royal residence. Even if they had enlisted a practice of setting guards, the walls were only made of layers of bark cloth that had been plastered over with clay and painted. I felt confident I could get in one way or another. Once I was within, it would not take me long to rifle through their library and steal what I needed. I could resupply at the same time. I had the grace to be ashamed of that thought. I also knew that shame would not keep me from doing it. Once again, I had no choice. I slogged up yet another ridge through the snow, and it seemed to me my heart beat out that phrase over and over again. No choice, no choice, no choice. Never any choice about anything. Fate had made me a killer, a liar, and a thief, and the harder I tried to avoid those roles, the more firmly I was pushed into them. Night Eyes padded at my heels and fretted about my black mood. So distracted were we that we crested the ridge and both of us stood, foolishly outlined in full view of the troop of horsemen, on the road below us. The yellow and brown of their jackets stood out against the snow. I froze like a startled deer. Even so, we might have escaped their notice were it not for the pack of hounds with them. I took it in at a glance. Six hounds, not wolf-hounds, thank Eda, but short-legged rabbit-hounds, unsuited to this weather or terrain. There was one long-legged dog, a gangly, curly-blacked mongrel. He and his handler moved separately from the pack. The pursuit was using whatever it had to find us. There were a dozen men on horseback, however. Almost instantly the mongrel threw his head up and bayed. In an instant the hounds took it up, milling, heads raised to snuff, and giving cry as they found our scents. The huntsman controlling the hounds lifted a hand and pointed up at us as we took to our heels. The mongrel and his handler were already racing toward us. I didn't even know there was a road there. I panted apologetically to Night Eyes as we fled down the hillside. We had a very brief advantage. We went downhill following our own trail, while the hounds and horsemen in pursuit of us must come up a hill of unbroken snow. I hoped that by the time they reached the ridge we had just left, we could be out of view in the brushy ravine below us. Night Eyes was holding back, loath to leave me behind. The hounds were baying, and I heard the voices of men raised in excitement as they took up the chase.
"Run!" I commanded Night Eyes. "I will not leave you."
"I'd have small chance if you did," I admitted. My mind worked frantically.
"Go to the bottom of the ravine. Lay as much false trail as you can. Loop around. Go downstream, following the ravine. When I get there, we'll flee uphill. It may delay them a while." "Fox tricks," he snorted, and then raced past me in a blur of grey and vanished into the thick brush of the ravine. I tried to drive myself faster through the snow. Just before I reached the brushy ravine's edge, I looked back. Dogs and horsemen were just cresting the ridge. I gained the shelter of the snow-cloaked brush and scrabbled down the steep sides. Night Eyes had left enough tracks there for a whole pack of wolves. Even as I paused for a quick breath, he raced past me in yet another direction.
"Let's get out of here!" I did not wait for his reply, but took off up the ravine as fast as my legs would carry me. The snow was shallower at the very bottom, for the overhanging trees and brush had caught and held most of it. I went half-doubled over, knowing that if I snagged on the branches they would dump their cold loads upon me. The belling of the hounds rang in the freezing air. I listened to it as I pushed my way on. When I heard their excitement give way to a frustrated canine yelling, I knew they had reached the muddled trail at the bottom of the ravine. Too soon. They were there too soon, and would be coming too fast.
"Night Eyes!"
"Silence, fool. The hounds will hear you. And that other." My heart near stopped in my chest. I could not believe how stupid I'd been. I flailed on through the snowy brush, my ears straining after what was happening behind us. The huntsmen had liked the false trail Night Eyes had left, and were all but forcing the hounds along it. There were too many men on horseback for the narrowness of the ravine. They were getting in one another's way, and perhaps fouling our true trail. Time gained, but only a bit of it. Then, suddenly, I heard alarmed cries and a wild yelping of hounds. I picked up a confused babble of doggy thoughts. A wolf had sprung down on them and raced right through the center of their pack, slashing as he went, dashing off right through the very legs of the horses the men rode behind them. One man was down and having trouble catching his wild-eyed mount. A dog had lost most of one floppy ear and was agonized with it. I tried to shut my mind to his pain. Poor beast. And all for none of your own gain. My legs were like lead and my mouth dry, but I tried to force speed from myself, to use well the time Night Eyes had gained at such risk to himself. I wanted to cry out to him to leave off his taunting, to flee with me,
but dared not betray to the pack the true direction of our retreat. Instead, I pushed myself on. The ravine was getting narrower and deeper. Vines and brambles and brush grew from the steepening sides and dangled down. I suspected I walked on top of a winter-frozen stream. I began to look for a way out of it. Behind me the hounds were yelping again, baying out to one another that they had the true trail now. Follow the wolf, the wolf, the wolf! I knew then with certainty that Night Eyes had shown himself to them and once more was deliberately drawing them away from me. Run, boy, run! He flung the thought to me, uncaring that the hounds would hear him. There was a wild merriment to him, a hysterical stillness to his thought. It reminded me of the night I had chased Justin through the halls of Buck Keep to slaughter him in the great hall before all the guests at Regal's king-in-waiting ceremony. Night Eyes was in a frenzy that had carried him past worrying over his own survival. I plunged on, my heart in my throat for him, fighting the tears that pricked the corners of my eyes. The ravine ended. Before me was a glistening cascade of ice, a memorial to the mountain stream that cupped this canyon during the summer months. The ice hung in long, rippled icicles down the face of a rocky crack in the mountain, gleaming with a faint sheen of moving water still. The snow at its base was crystalline. I halted, suspecting a deep pool, one I might unwittingly find under a layer of too thin ice. I lifted my eyes. The walls here were mostly undercut and overgrown. In other places, bare slabs of rock showed through the drapery of snow. Runty saplings and twiggy brush grew in a scattering, leaning out to catch the sunlight from above. None of it looked promising for a climb. I turned to double back on my trail and heard a single howl rise and fall. Neither hound nor wolf. It could only be the mongrel dog. Something in the certainty of his cry convinced me he was on my trail. I heard a man shout encouragement, and the dog yelped again. Closer. I turned to the wall of the ravine and started to climb. I heard the man halloo to the others, calling and whistling for them to follow him. He had a man's tracks here. Never mind the wolf. It was just a wit track. In the distance, the hounds suddenly took up a different yelping. In that moment, I knew that Regal had finally found what he had sought. A witted one to hunt me. Old blood had been bought. I jumped and caught at a sapling leaning out from the wall of the ravine. I hauled myself up, got my feet on it, balanced, and reached for another above me. When I put my weight on it, its roots tore loose from the rocky soil. I fell, but managed to catch myself on the first tree again. Up again, I told myself fiercely. I stood on it, and heard it crack under my weight. I reached up to grab handfuls of twiggy brush, leaning down from the undercut bank. I tried to go up quickly, to not let my weight hang from any sapling or brush for more than a few moments. Handfuls of twigs broke off in my grip, tufts of old grasses pulled free, and I found myself scrabbling along the lip of the ravine, but not getting any higher. I heard a shout below me, and against my will I glanced back and down. A man and dog were in the clearing below. As the mongrel bayed up at me, the man was knocking an arrow to his bow. I hung, helpless above them. As easy a shot as a man could wish. Please! I heard myself gasp, and then heard the tiny, unmistakable sound of a bowstring being released. I felt it hit me. A fist in the back. One of Regal's old tricks from my childhood, and then a deeper, hotter pain inside me. One of my hands had let go. I had not commanded it to, it had simply come unhooked from its grip. I swung from my right hand. I could hear so clearly the yelping of the dog as it smelled my blood. I could hear the rustle of the man's garment as he drew another arrow from his quiver. Pain bit again, deep into my right wrist. I cried out as my fingers let go. In a reflex of terror, my legs scrabbled fiercely against the yielding brush that dangled over the undercut bank. And somehow, I was rising, my face brushing crusty snow. I found my left arm and made vague swimming motions with it.
"Get your legs up,"
Night Eyes snapped at me. He made not a sound, for his teeth were set firmly in the sleeve and flesh of my right arm as he dragged me up. The chance at living rejuvenated me. I kicked wildly and then felt solid ground under my belly. I clawed my way forward, trying to ignore the pain that centered in my back, but spread out from there in red waves. If I had not seen the man loose an arrow, I would have believed I had a pole as thick as a wagon axle sticking out of my back.
"Get up, get up, we have to run."
I don't recall how I got to my feet. I heard dogs scrabbling up the cliff behind me. Night Eyes stood back from the edge and met them as they came up. His jaws tore them open, and he flung their bodies back down on the rest of the pack. When the curly-backed mongrel fell, there was a sudden lessening in the yelping below. We both knew his agony, and heard the screams of the man below as his bond animal bled to death in the snow. The other huntsman was calling his dogs off, angrily telling the others it would do no good to send them up to be slaughtered. I could hear the men yelling and cursing as they turned their weary horses and started back down the ravine, to try to find a place where they could get up and after us, to try and pick up our trail again.
"Run,"
Night Eyes told me. We would not speak of what we had just done. There was a sensation of terrible warmth running down my back that was also a spreading coldness. I put my hand to my chest, almost expecting to feel the arrowhead and shaft sticking out there, but no, it was buried deep. I staggered after Night Eyes, my consciousness awash in too much sensation, too many kinds of pain. My shirt and cloak tugged against the arrow shaft as I moved, a tiny wiggling of the wood that was echoed by the arrowhead deep inside me. I wondered how much further damage it was doing. I thought of the times I had butchered arrow-slain deer, of the black, puddingy flesh full of blood that one found around such a wound. I wondered if he'd got my lung. A lung-shot deer didn't go far. Did I taste blood in the back of my throat?
"Don't think about it,"
Night Eyes commanded me savagely.
"You weaken us both. Just walk, walk, and keep walking."
So he knew as well as I did that I could not run. I walked, and he walked at my side. For a time. Then I was walking blindly forward in the dark, not even caring in which direction I went. And he was not there. I groped for him, but could not find him. Somewhere afar, I heard the yelping of dogs again. I walked on. I blundered into trees. Branches scratched my face, but it was all right, because my face was numb. The shirt on my back was a slushy sheet of frozen blood that moved chafingly against my skin. I tried to pull my cloak more closely around me, but the sudden pain nearly drove me to my knees. Silly me. I had forgotten it would drag against the arrow shaft. Silly me.
"Keep walking, boy."
I walked on. I bumped into another tree. It released a shower of snow on me. I staggered clear and kept on walking. For a long time. Then I was sitting in the snow, getting colder and colder. I had to get up. I had to keep moving. I walked again. Not for very long, I don't think. Under the shelter of some great evergreens where the snow was shallow. I sank to my knees.
"Please,"
I said. I had not the strength to weep for mercy.
"Please."
I could not think whom I was asking. I saw a hollow between two thick roots. Pine needles were thick on the ground there. I huddled into the small space. I could not lie down for the arrow sticking out of my back. But I could lean on my forehead against the friendly tree and cross my arms on my chest. I made myself small, folding my legs under me and sinking into the space between the roots. I would have been cold, save I was too tired. I sank into sleep. When I woke up, I'd build a fire and get warm. I could imagine how warm I'd be, could almost feel it.
"My brother!"
"I'm here," I told him calmly.
"Right here."
I quested out to touch him reassuringly. He was coming. The ruff around his throat was spiky with frozen saliva, but not a tooth had got through. He had one slash down the side of his muzzle, but it was not bad. He'd led them in circles and then harried their horses from behind, before leaving them plunging through a snow-covered swale of deep grass in the dark. Only two of their dogs were left alive, and one of the horses was limping so badly, the rider had doubled up with another. Now he came to find me, surging up the snowy slopes easily. He was tired, yes, but the energy of triumph surged through him. The night was crisp and clean around him. He caught the scent, and then the tiny eye flicker of the hare that crouched beneath a bush, hoping he'd pass by. We did not. A single, sudden, sideways pounce, and the hare was in his jaws. We clutched it by its bony head and snapped its spine with one shake. We trotted on. The meat a welcome, dangling weight from his jaws. We would eat well. The night forest was silver and black around us.
"Stop, my brother. Do not do this."
"Do what?"
"I love you, but I do not wish to be you."
I hovered where I was. His lungs, working so strongly, drawing in the cold night air past the hare's head in his mouth, the slight sting of the slash down his muzzle, his powerful legs carrying his lean body so well.
"You do not wish to be me either, Changer. Not really."
I was not sure he was correct. With his eyes I saw and smelled myself. I had wedged myself into the space between the roots of the great tree and was curled up, as small as an abandoned pup. My blood smell was strong in the air. Then I blinked. And I was looking down into the darkness of my crooked elbow over my face. I lifted my head slowly, painfully. Everything hurt, and all the pain traced back to that arrow, centered in my back. I smelled rabbit guts and blood. Night Eyes stood beside me, feet braced on the carcass as he tore it open.
"Eat while it's hot."
"I don't know if I can."
"Do you want me to chew it for you?"
He was not jesting. But the only thing more revolting than eating was the thought of eating disgorged meat. I managed a tiny shake of my head. My fingers were almost numb, but I watched my hand pinch up the small liver and carry it up to my mouth. It was warm and rich with blood. Suddenly, I knew Night Eyes was right. I had to eat because I had to live. He had torn the hare apart. I picked up a portion and bit into the warm meat. It was tough, but I was determined. Without thinking, I had nearly abandoned my body for his, nearly climbed in beside him into that perfect, healthy wolf's body. I had done it once before, with his consent. But now we both knew better. We would share, but we could never become one another. Not without both of us losing. Slowly I sat up. I felt the muscles of my back move against the arrow, protesting the way it snagged them. I could feel the weight of the shaft. When I imagined it sticking out of me, I nearly lost the food I'd eaten. I forced myself to a calm I did not feel. Suddenly, oddly, an image of Burridge came to me. That deadly stillness in his face when he had flexed his knee and watched the old wound pulling open. Slowly, I reached my hand back. I walked my fingers up my spine. It made the muscles pull against the arrow. Finally, my fingers touching the sticky wood of the arrow's shaft. Even that light touch was a new sort of pain. Awkwardly, I closed my fingers around the shaft, closed my eyes and tried to pull on it. Even if there had been no pain involved, it would have been difficult. But the agony rocked the world around me, and when it steadied, I found myself on my hands and knees, with my head hanging down. "Shall I try?" I shook my head, remaining as I was. I was still afraid I'd faint. I tried to think. If he pulled it out, I knew I'd pass out. If the bleeding was bad, I'd have no way to stop it. No. Best to leave it in there. I gathered all my courage. "Can you break it off?" He came close to me. I felt his head against my back. He turned his head, maneuvered his jaws so that his back teeth would close on the shaft. Then he closed his jaws. There was a snick, like a gardener pruning a sapling, and a shiver of new pain. A wave of giddiness washed over me, but somehow I reached back and tugged my blood-sodden cloak free of the stub of arrow. I pulled it closer around me, shuddering. I closed my eyes. "No, build a fire first." I peeled my eyes open again. It was all too hard. I scraped together all the twigs and sticks within easy reach. Night Eyes tried to help, fetching branches to me, but it still took an eternity before I had a tiny flame dancing. Slowly, I added sticks. About the time I had the fire burning, I realized the day was dawning. Time to move on again. We stayed only to finish eating the rabbit and to let me get my hands and feet thoroughly warm. Then we started off again. Night Eyes leading me, unpityingly onward.
20. Jampe. Jampe, the capital city of the Mountain Kingdom, is older than Buckkeep, just as the ruling line of the Mountain Kingdom is older than the House of Farseer. As a city, Jampe is as far removed in style from the fortress city of Buckkeep as the Farseer monarchs are different from the philosopher guides of the sacrifice lineage that rules the mountains. There is no permanent city, such as we know. There are few permanent buildings. Instead, along the carefully planned and garden-bordered roads are spaces where nomadic folk of the mountains may come and go. There is a designated space for the market, but the merchants migrate in a procession that parallels that of the seasons. A score of tents may spring up overnight, and their inhabitants swell the population of Jampe for a week or a month, only to disappear without a trace when their visiting and trading is over. Jampe is an ever-changing city of tents, populated by the vigorous outdoor-dwelling folk of the mountains. The homes of the ruling family and the companions that choose to stay year-round with them are not at all like our castles and halls. Instead, their dwellings center around great trees, living still, their trunks and branches patiently trained over scores of years to provide a framework for the building. This living structure is then draped with a fabric woven of tree bark fibers and reinforced with a latticework. Thus, the walls can take on the gently curving shapes of a tulip bud or the dome of an egg. A clay coating is spread over the fabric layer, and this in turn is painted with a shiny, resinous paint in the bright hues the mountain folk enjoy. Some are decorated with fanciful creatures or patterns, but most are left simple. Purples and yellows predominate, so that to come upon the city growing in the shade of the great mountain trees is like coming upon a patch of crocus in springtime. About these homes and at the intersections of the roads in this nomadic city are the gardens. Each is unique,
One may center around an unusually shaped stump, or an arrangement of stones, or a graceful bit of wood. They may contain fragrant herbs or bright flowers, or any combination of plants. One notable one has at its heart a bubbling spring of steaming water. Here grow plants with fleshy leaves and exotically scented flowers, denizens of some warmer clime brought here to delight the mountain dwellers with their mystery. Often, visitors leave gifts in the gardens when they depart, a wooden carving or a graceful pot, or perhaps merely an arrangement of bright pebbles. The gardens belong to no one, and all tend them. At Jampe can also be found hot springs, some of water that can scald a man, others merely a gently bubbling warmth. These have been confined both as public baths and as a source of heat in some of the smaller dwellings. In every building, in every garden, at every turn, the visitor finds the austere beauty and simplicity of color and form that are the mountain ideal. The overall impression that one carries away is of tranquility and joy in the natural world. The chosen simplicity of life there may lead the visitor to question his own choice in life. It was night. I recall little more than that it followed long days of pain. I moved my staff and took another step. I moved my staff again. We were not going quickly. A scurrying of snowflakes in the air was more blinding than the darkness. I could not get away from the circling wind that carried them. Night eyes wove a pacing path around me, guiding my hesitant steps as if it could hurry me. From time to time he keened anxiously. His body was tight with fear and weariness. He smelled wood smoke and goats.
"Not to betray you, my brother, but to help you. Remember that. You need someone with hands, but if they try to mistreat you, you have but to call and I shall come. I shall not be far." I could not make my mind focus on his thoughts. I felt his bitterness that he could not help me, and his fear that he was leading me into a trap. I thought we had been arguing, but I could not remember what I had been insisting on. Whatever it was, Night Eyes had won, simply by virtue of knowing what he wanted. My feet slipped on the packed snow of the road, and I went to my knees. Night Eyes sat down beside me and waited. I tried to lie down, and he seized my wrist in his jaws. He tugged gently, but the thing in my back burst into sudden flames. I made a noise.
"Please, my brother, there are huts ahead and lights within them, fires and warmth, and someone with hands who can cleanse the foul wound in your back. Please, get up. Just once more."
I lifted my hanging head and tried to see. There was something in the road ahead of us, something the road forked and went around on either side. The silver moonlight gleamed on it, but I could not make out what it was. I blinked hard, and it became a carved stone, taller than a man. It had not been shaped to be an object, but was simply smoothed into a graceful shape. At its base, bare twiggy limbs recalled summer shrubbery. An irregular wall of smaller stones bordered it. Snow garnished all. It reminded me of Ketrikan, somehow. I tried to rise, but could not. Beside me, Night Eyes whined in agony. I could not frame a thought to reassure him. It took all my strength to remain on my knees. I did not hear footsteps, but I felt a sudden increase in the tension thrumming through Night Eyes. I lifted my head again, far ahead of me, past the garden. Someone came walking through the night. Tall and slender, draped in heavy fabric, hood pulled forward so far it was almost a cowl. I watched the person come. "Death," I thought. Only death could come so silently, gliding so smoothly through this icy night.
"Run away,"
I whispered to Night Eyes.
"No sense in letting him take both of us. Run away now."
For a wonder, he obeyed me, slipping away silently from my side. When I turned my head, I could not see him, but I sensed he was not far. I felt his strength leave me as if I had taken off a warm coat. Part of me tried to go with him, to cling to the wolf and be the wolf. I longed to leave this battered body behind.
"If you must, my brother, if you must, I will not turn you away."
I wished he had not said it. It did not make it easier to resist the temptation. I had promised myself I would not do that to him, that if die I must, I would die, and leave him free and clean of me to carve his own life. Yet as the moment for dying grew nearer, there seemed so many good reasons to forsake that promise. The healthy, wild body, that simple life in the now, called to me. Slowly, the figure drew nearer. A great shivering of cold and pain racked me. I could go to the wolf. I summoned the last of my strength to defy myself.
"Here,"
I croaked to death.
"Here I am. Come and take me and let it be done at last."
He heard me. I saw him halt and stand stiffly as if afraid. Then he came with sudden haste, his white cloak swirling in the night wind. He stood by me, tall and slender and silent.
"I've come to you,"
I whispered. Abruptly he knelt beside me, and I glimpsed the chiseled ivory of his bony face. He put his arms around me and lifted me to bear me away. The pressure of his arm on my back was agonizing. I fainted. Warmth was seeping back into me, bringing pain with it. I sprawled on my side within walls, for the wind surged like the ocean outside. I smelled tea and incense, paint and wood shavings, and the wool rug I lay on. My face burned. I could not stop the shuddering that ran through me, though every wave of it awakened the searing pain in my back. My hands and feet throbbed.
"The knots of your cloak strings are frozen. I'm going to cut them now. Lie still."
The voice was curiously gentle, as if unused to such a tone. I managed to get an eye open. I was lying on the floor. My face was turned toward a stone hearth where a fire burned. Someone leaned over me. I saw the glitter of a blade nearing my throat, but I could not move. I felt it sawing, and honestly could not tell if it tasted my flesh. Then my cloak was being lifted back.
"It's frozen to your shirt,"
someone muttered. I almost thought I knew the voice.
A gasp. "It's blood. All this is frozen blood."
My cloak made an odd tearing sound as it was peeled loose. Then someone sat down on the floor beside me. I turned my eyes up slowly but could not lift my head to see a face. Instead, I saw a slender body clothed in a soft robe of white wool. Hands the color of ivory pushed the cuffs of his sleeves up. The fingers were long and thin, the wrists bony. Then he rose abruptly to get something. For a time I was alone. I closed my eyes. When I opened them, a wide vessel of blue pottery was by my head. Steam rose from it, and I smelled willow and rowan.
"Steady,"
said the voice, and for a moment one of those hands rested on my shoulder reassuringly. Then I felt spreading warmth on my back.
"I'm bleeding again,"
I whispered to myself.
"No, I'm soaking the shirt loose."
Once again, the voice was almost familiar. I closed my eyes. A door opened and shut, and a gust of cold air wafted across me. The man beside me paused. I felt him glance up.
"You might have knocked,"
he said with mock severity. I felt again the warm trickle of water on my back.
"Even one such as I occasionally has other guests."
Feet crossed hastily to me. Someone lowered herself fluidly to the floor beside me. I saw the folding of her skirts as she sank down. A hand pushed the hair back from my face.
Who is he, Holy One?
Holy One?
There was bitter humor in his voice.
If you would speak of holes, you should speak to him, not me. Here, look at his back.
He spoke softer then.
As to who he is, I have no idea.
I heard her gasp.
All of that is blood. How does he yet live? Let us get some warmth to him and clean away the blood.
Then she tugged at my mittens and dragged them free of my hands.
Oh, his poor hands, his fingers all gone black at the ends.
She exclaimed in horror. That I did not want to see or know. I let go of everything. For a time it seemed as if I were a wolf again. I stalked an unfamiliar village, alert for dogs or anyone stirring about. But all was white silence and snow falling in the night. I found the hut I sought and prowled about it, but dared not enter it. After a time, it seemed I had done all I could about something. So I went hunting. I killed. I ate. I slept. When I opened my eyes again, the room was washed with the pale light of day. The walls curved. I thought at first my eyes would not focus, and then I recognized the shape of a mountain dwelling. Slowly I took in detail. Thick rugs of wool on the floor, simple wooden furniture, a window of greased hide. On a shelf, two dolls leaned their heads together beside a wooden horse and tiny cart. A huntsman puppet dangled in a corner. On a table were bits of brightly painted wood. I smelled the clean shavings and the fresh paint.
Puppets, I thought. Someone was making puppets.
I was belly down on a bed with a blanket over me. I was warm. The skin of my face and my hands and feet burned unpleasantly, but that could be ignored, for the great pain that bored into my back took precedence. My mouth was not so dry. Had I drunk something? I seemed to recall the spill of warm tea in my mouth, but it was not a definite memory. Feet in felted wool slippers approached my bed. Someone bent down and lifted the blanket off me. Cool air flowed across my skin. Deft hands moved over me, prodding the area around my wound.
So thin. Were he better fleshed, I'd say he had more chance,
said an old woman's voice sadly.
Will he keep his toes and fingers?
A woman's voice. Close by, a young woman. I could not see her, but she was near. The other woman bent over me. She handled my hands, bending the fingers and pinching at the ends of them. I winced and tried feebly to pull away.
If he lives, he'll keep his fingers, she said,
not unkindly, but factually.
They will be tender, for he must shed all the skin and flesh that was frozen. By themselves they are not too bad. The infection in his back is what may kill him. There's something inside that wound, an arrowhead and part of the shaft by the look of it. Cannot you take it out?
Ivoryhan spoke from somewhere in the room.
Easily,
the woman replied. I realized she was speaking the tongue of Buck, with a mountain accent.
But he will certainly bleed, and he has not much blood left he can part with. And the foulness of his wound may spread in fresh flowing blood to poison all his body.
She sighed.
Would that Jong Kui was still alive. She was very wise in this type of thing. It was she who pulled from Prince Rurisk the arrow that had pierced his chest. The wound bubbled with his very life's breath, and still she did not let him die. I am not such a healer as she, but I will try. I will send my apprentice with a salve for his hands and feet and face, rub his skin well with it each day, and do not be dismayed at the shedding of skin. As for his back, we must keep a drawing poultice on, to suck the poison from it as best we may. Food and drink you must get into him, as much as he will take. Let him rest.
and a week hence we will pull that arrow and hope he has built the strength to live through it. Joffron, know you a good drawing poultice?
One or two. Bran and goosegrass is a good one,
she offered.
It would do well.
Would that I could stay and tend him, but I have many another to see to. Cedar Knoll was attacked last night. A bird has come with tidings that many were injured before the soldiers were driven off. I cannot tend one and leave many. I must leave him in your hands.
And in my bed?
Ivory Hands said dolefully. I heard the door close behind the healer. I drew in a deeper breath, but found no strength to speak. Behind me, I heard the man moving about the hut. The small sounds of water poured and crockery moved. Footsteps came closer.
I think he's awake,
Joffron said softly. I gave a small nod against my pillow.
Try to get this down him, then, suggested Ivory Hands. Then let him rest. I shall return with bran and goosegrass for your poultice. And some bedding for myself, for I suppose he must stay here.
A tray was passed over my body, and came into my view. There were a bowl and a cup on it. A woman sat beside me. I could not turn my head to see her face, but the fabrics of her skirt were mountain-woven. Her hand spooned up a bit from the bowl and offered it to me. I sipped at it cautiously. Some sort of broth. From the cup wafted the scents of chamomile and valerian. I heard a door slide open, and then shut. I felt a waft of cold air move through the room. Another spoonful of broth. A third.
Where?
I managed to say.
What?
She asked, leaning closer. She turned her head and leaned down to see my face.
Blue eyes?
Too close to my own.
Did you say something?
I refused the spoon. It was suddenly too much effort to eat, even though what I had taken had heartened me.
The room seemed darker.
When next I awoke, night was deep around me. All was silent, save for the muted crackling of a fire in the hearth. The light it cast was fitful, but enough to show me the room. I felt feverish and very weak, and horribly thirsty. There was a cup of water on a low table near my bed. I tried to reach for it, but the pain in my back stopped my arm's movement. My back felt taut with the swollen wound. Any movement awakened it.
Water,
I mouthed, but the dryness of my mouth made it a whisper. No one came. Near the hearth, my host had made up a pallet for himself. He slept like a cat, lax, but with that aura of constant wariness. His head was pillowed on his outstretched arm, and the fire glazed him with light. I looked at him, and my heart turned over in my chest. His hair was smoothed back, sleek on his skull, confined to a single plait, bearing the clean lines of his face, expressionless and still. It seemed a chiseled mask. The last trace of boyishness had been burned away, leaving only the clean planes of his lean cheeks and high forehead and long, straight nose. His lips were narrower, his chin firmer than I recalled. The dance of the firelight lent color to his face, staining his white skin with its amber. The fool had grown up in the time we had been apart. It seemed too much change for 12 months, and yet this year had been longer than any in my life. For a time, I simply lay and looked at him. His eyes opened slowly, as if I had spoken to him. For a time he stared back at me without a word. Then a frown creased his brow. He sat up slowly, and I saw that truly he was ivory, his hair the color of fresh ground flour. It was his eyes that stopped my heart and tongue. They caught the firelight, yellow as a cat's. I finally found my breath.
Fool!
I sighed sadly.
What have they done to you?
My parched mouth could barely shape the words. I reached out my hand to him, but the movement pulled the muscles of my back, and I felt my injury open again. The world tilted and slid away. Safety. That was my first clear sensation. It came from the soft warmth of the clean bedding, the herb fragrance of the pillow beneath my head. Something warm and slightly damp pressed gently on my wound and muffled its stab. Safety clasped me as gently as the cool hands that held my frostbitten hands between them. I opened my eyes, and the firelit room slowly swam into focus. He was sitting by my bed. There was a stillness about him that was not repose, as he stared past me and into the darkened room. He wore a plain robe of white wool, with a round collar. The simple clothes were a shock after the years of seeing him in motley. It was like seeing a garish puppet stripped of its paint. Then a single silver tear trickled down one cheek beside the narrow face. I was astonished.
Fool.
My voice came out as a croak this time. His eyes came instantly to mine, and he dropped to his knees beside me. His breath came and went raggedly in his throat. He snatched up the cup of water and held it to my mouth while I drank. Then he set it aside, to take up my dangling hand. He spoke softly as he did this, more to himself than to me.
"What have they done to me, Fitz? Gods, what have they done to you to mock you so? What has become of me that I did not even know you, though I carried you in my arms?"
His cool fingers moved tentatively down my face, tracing the scar and the broken nose. He leaned down suddenly to rest his brow against mine.
"When I recall how beautiful you were,"
he whispered brokenly, and then fell silent. The warm drip of his tear against my face felt scalding. He sat up abruptly, clearing his throat. He wiped his sleeve across his eyes, a child's gesture that unmanned me even more. I drew a deeper breath and gathered myself.
"You've changed,"
I managed to say.
"Have I? I imagine I have. How could I not have changed? I thought you dead, and all my life for naught. Then now, this moment, to be given back both you and my life's purpose. I opened my eyes to you and thought my heart would stop, that madness had finally claimed me. Then you spoke my name."
"Changed, you say? More than you can imagine."
"As much as you have plainly changed yourself. This night, I hardly know myself."
It was as close as I had ever heard the fool come to babbling. He took a breath, and his voice cracked on his next words.
"For a year, I have believed you dead, Fitz. For a whole year."
He had not released my hand. I felt the trembling that went through him. He stood suddenly, saying,
"We both need something to drink."
He walked away from me across the darkened room. He had grown, but it was in shape rather than size. I doubted he was much taller, but his body was no longer a child's. He was lean and slight as ever, muscled, as tumblers are. He brought a bottle from a cabinet, two simple cups. He uncorked the bottle, and I smelled the warmth of the brandy before he poured. He came back to sit by my bed and offer me a cup. I managed to wrap my hand around it, despite my blackened fingertips. He seemed to have recovered some of his aplomb. He looked at me over the rim as he drank. I lifted my head and tipped a spill of mine into my mouth. Half went down my beard, and I choked as if I had never had brandy before. Then I felt the hot race of it in my belly. The fool shook his head as he gently wiped my face.
I should have listened to my dreams. Over and over I dreamed you were coming. It was all you ever said in the dream, I am coming. Instead, I believed so firmly that I had failed somehow, that the catalyst was dead. I could not even see who you were when I picked you up from the ground.
Fool, I said quietly. I wished he would stop speaking. I simply wanted to be safe for a time, and think of nothing. He did not understand.
He looked at me and grinned his old sly fool smile.
You still don't understand, do you? When word reached us that you were dead, that Regal had killed you. My life ended. It was worse, somehow, when the pilgrims began to trickle in to hail me as the White Prophet. I knew I was the White Prophet. I have known it since I was a child, as did those who raised me. I grew up knowing that some day I would come north to find you, and that between the two of us we would put time in its proper course. All of my life I knew I would do that. I was not much more than a child when I set out. Alone, I made my way to Buckkeep to seek the catalyst that only I would recognize, and I found you, and I knew you, though you did not know yourself. I watched the ponderous turning of events and marked how each time you were the pebble that shifted that great wheel from its ancient path. I tried to speak to you of it, but you would have none of it. The catalyst? Not you. Oh, no.
He laughed, almost fondly. He drained off the rest of his brandy at a gulp, then held my cup to my lips. I sipped. He rose, then, to pace a turn about the room, and then halted to refill his cup. He came back to me again.
I saw it all come to the tottering brink of ruin. But always you were there, the card never dealt before, the side of the die that had never before fallen uppermost. When my king died, as I knew he must, there was an heir to the Farseer line, and Fitzchivalry yet lived, the catalyst that would change all things so that an heir would ascend to the throne.
He gulped his brandy again, and when he spoke, the scent of it rode his breath.
I fled with Ketrickin and the unborn child, grieving yet confident that all would come to pass as it must, for you were the catalyst. But when word came to us that you were dead...
He halted abruptly. When he tried to speak again, his voice had gone thick and lost its music.
It made me a lie. How could I be the White Prophet if the catalyst were dead? What could I predict? The changes that could have been, had you lived. What would I be but a witness as the world spun deeper and deeper into ruin? I had no purpose any more. Your life was more than half of mine, you see. It was in the interweaving of our doings that I existed. Worse, I came to wonder if any part of the world were truly what I believed it. Was I a White Prophet at all, or was it but some peculiar madness, a self-deception to console a freak?
For a year, Fitz. A year. I grieved for a friend I had lost, and I grieved for the world that somehow I had doomed. My failure, all of it. And when Ketrickin's child, my last hope, came into the world still and blue... What could it be but my doing somehow?
No!
The word burst from me with a strength I had not known I had. The fool flinched as if I had struck him. Then,
yes,
he said simply, carefully taking my hand again.
I am sorry. I should have known you did not know. The Queen was devastated at the loss. And I. The Farseer heir. My last hope crumbled away. I had held myself together, telling myself, well, if the child lives and ascends the throne, perhaps that will have been enough. But when she was brought to bed with naught but a dead babe for all her travails, I felt my whole life had been a farce, a sham, an evil jest played on me by time. But now...
He closed his eyes a moment.
Now I find you truly alive. So I live. And again, suddenly, I believe, once more I know who I am.
and who my catalyst is."
He laughed aloud, never dreaming how his words chilled my blood.
"I had no faith. I, the White Prophet, did not believe my own foreseeing. Yet here we are, Fitz, and all will still come to pass as it was ever meant to do."
Again he tipped the bottle to fill his cup. The liquor, when he poured it, was the color of his eyes. He saw me staring and grinned delightedly.
"Ah, you say, but the White Prophet is no longer white. I suspect it is the way of my kind. I may gain more color now as the years pass."
He made a deprecating motion.
"But that is of little import. I have already talked too much. Tell me, Fitz, tell me all. How did you survive? Why are you here?"
"Verity calls me. I must go to him." The fool drew in his breath at my words. Not a gasp, but a slow inhalation, as if he took life back into himself. He almost glowed with pleasure at my words.
"So he lives! Ah!"
Before I could speak no more, he lifted his hands.
"Slowly. Tell me all in order. These are words I have hungered to hear. I must know everything."
And so I tried. My strength was small, and sometimes I felt myself borne up on my fever, so that my words wandered, and I could not recall where I had left off my tale of the past year. I got as far as Regal's dungeon, then could only say, "He had me beaten and starved." The fool's quick glance at my scarred face and the casting aside of his eyes told me he understood. He, too, had known Regal too well. When he waited to hear more, I shook my head slowly. He nodded, then put a smile on his face.
"It's all right, Fitz. You are weary. You have already told me what I most long to hear. The rest will keep. For now, I shall tell you of my year."
I tried to listen, clinging to the important words, storing them in my heart. There was so much I had wondered for so long. Regal had suspected the escape. Ketrickin had returned to her rooms to find that her carefully chosen and packed supplies were gone, spirited away by Regal's spies. She had left with little more than the clothes on her back and a hastily grabbed cloak. I heard of the evil weather the fool and Ketrickin had faced the night they slipped away from Buckkeep. She had ridden my sooty, and the fool had battled headstrong Ruddy all the way across the six duchies in winter. They had reached Blue Lake at the end of the winter storms. The fool had supported them and earned their passage on a ship by painting his face and dyeing his hair and juggling in the streets. What color had he painted his skin? White, of course, all the better to hide the stark white skin that Regal's spies would be watching for. They had crossed the lake with little incident, and passed Moon's Eye and traveled into the mountains. Immediately, Ketrickin had sought her father's aid in finding what had become of Verity. He had indeed passed through Jampe, but nothing had been heard of him since. Ketrickin had put riders on his trail and even joined in the search herself. But all her hopes had come to grief. Far up in the mountains she had found the site of a battle. The winter and the scavengers had done their work. No one man could be identified, but Verity's buck standard was there. The scattered arrows and hewn ribs of one body showed it was men and not the beasts or elements that had attacked them. There were not enough skulls to go with the bodies, and the scattering of the bones made the number of dead uncertain. Ketrickin had clung to hope, until a cloak had been found that she remembered packing for Verity. Her hands had embroidered the buck on the breast patch. A tumble of mouldering bones and ragged garments were beneath it. Ketrickin had mourned her husband as dead. She had returned to Jampe to pendulum between devastated grief and seething rage at Regal's plots. Her fury had solidified into a determination that she would see Verity's child upon the Six Duchies' throne and a fair reign returned to the folk. Those plans had sustained her until the stillbirth of her child. The fool had scarcely seen her since, save to catch glimpses of her pacing through her frozen gardens, her face as still as the snows that overlaid the beds. There was more shuffled in with his account of both major and minor news for me. Sooty and Ruddy were both alive and well. Sooty was in foal to the young stallion despite her years. I shook my head over that. Regal had been doing his best to provoke a war. The roving gangs of bandits that now plagued the mountain folk were thought to be in his pay. Shipments of grain that had been paid for in spring had never been delivered, nor had the mountain traders been permitted to cross the border with their wares. Several small villages close to the Six Duchies border had been found looted and burned with no survivors. King Eod's wrath, slow to stir, was now at white heat. Although the mountain folk had no standing army as such, there was not one inhabitant who would not take up arms at the word of their sacrifice. War was imminent. Andy had tales of Patience, the lady of Buckkeep, brought erratically by word of mouth, passed among merchants and on to smugglers. She did all she could to defend Buck's Coast. Money was dwindling, but the folk of the land gave to her what they called the lady's levy, and she disposed of it as best she could amongst her soldiers and sailors. Buckkeep had not fallen yet, though the raiders now had encampments up and down the whole coastline of the Six Duchies. Winter had quieted the war, but spring would bathe the coast in blood once more. Some of the smaller keeps spoke of treaties with the red ships. Some openly paid tribute in the hopes of avoiding forging. The coastal duchies would not survive another summer, so said Chade. My tongue was silent as the fool spoke of him. He had come to Jampe by secret ways in high summer, disguised as an old peddler, but made himself known to the queen when he arrived. The fool had seen him then.
"War agrees with him," the fool observed. "He strides about like a man of 20. He carries a sword at his hip, and there is fire in his eyes. He was pleased to see how her belly swelled with the far-seer air, and they spoke bravely of Verity's child on the throne." But that was high summer," he sighed. "Now I hear he has returned. I believe because the queen has sent word of her stillbirth. I have not seen him yet. What hope he can offer us now I do not know."
He shook his head.
"There must be an heir to the Farseer throne," he insisted. "Verity must get one. Otherwise..."
He made a helpless gesture.
"Why not Regal? Would not a child from his loins suffice?"
"No."
His eyes went afar.
"No. I can tell you that quite clearly, yet I cannot tell you why. Only that in all futures I have seen he makes no child, not even a bastard. In all times he reigns as the last Farseer, and ushers in the dark."
A shiver walked over me.
He was too strange when he spoke of such things, and his odd words had brought another worry into my mind.
There were two women, a minstrel starling and an old woman pilgrim, Kettle. They were on their way here. Kettle said she sought the White Prophet.
I little thought he might be you. Have you heard aught of them? Have they reached Jampe Town?
He shook his head slowly.
No one has come seeking the White Prophet since winter closed on us.
He halted, reading the worry in my face.
Of course, I do not know of all who come here. They may be in Jampe, but I have heard nothing of two such as that.
He reluctantly added,
Bandits prey on roadside travellers now. Perhaps they were delayed.
Perhaps they were dead. They had come back for me. And I had sent them on alone.
Fitz?
I'm all right, fool. A favor.
I like not that tone already. What is it?
Tell no one I am here. Tell no one I am alive. Just yet.
He sighed.
Not even Ketriken? To tell her that Verity lives still?
Fool.
What I have come to do I intend to do alone. I would not raise false hopes in her. She has endured the news of his death once. If I can bring him back to her, then will be time enough for true rejoicing. I know I ask much, but let me be a stranger you are aiding. Later, I may need your aid in obtaining an old map from the Jampe libraries. But when I leave here, I would go alone. I think this quest is one best accomplished quietly. I glanced aside from him and added, "Let Fitz Chivalry remain dead. Mostly, it is better so."
"Surely you will at least see Chade?"
He was incredulous.
"Not even Chade should know I live."
I paused, wondering which would anger the old man more, that I had attempted to kill Regal when he had always forbidden it, or that I had so badly botched the task.
"This quest must be mine alone."
I watched him, and saw a grudging acceptance in his face. He sighed again.
"I will not say I agree with you completely, but I shall tell no one who you are."
He gave a small laugh. Talk fell off between us. The bottle of brandy was empty. We were reduced to silence, staring at one another drunkenly. The fever and the brandy burned in me. I had too many things to think of and too little I could do about any of them. If I lay very still, the pain in my back subsided to a red throb. It kept pace with the beating of my heart.
"Too bad you didn't manage to kill Regal,"
the fool observed suddenly.
"I know. I tried. As a conspirator and an assassin, I'm a failure."
He shrugged for me.
"You were never really good at it, you know. There was a naivete to you that none of the ugliness could stain, as if you never truly believed in evil. It was what I liked best about you."
The fool swayed lightly where he was, but righted himself.
"It was what I missed most, when you were dead."
I smiled foolishly.
"A while back, I thought it was my great beauty."
For a time the fool just looked at me. Then he glanced aside and spoke quietly.
"Unfair. Were I myself, I would never have spoken such words aloud. Still, ah, Fitz."
He looked at me and shook his head fondly. He spoke without mockery, making almost a stranger of himself.
"Perhaps half of it was that you were so unaware of it. Not like Regal. Now there's a pretty man, but he knows it too well. You never see him with his hair tousled or the red of the wind on his cheeks."
For a moment, I felt oddly uncomfortable. Then I said,
"Nor with an arrow in his back, more's the pity."
And we both went off into the foolish laughter that only drunks understand. It woke the pain in my back to a stabbing intensity, however, and in a moment I was grasping for breath. The fool rose, steadier on his feet than I would have expected, to take a drippy bag of something off my back and replace it with one almost uncomfortably warm from a pot on the hearth. That done, he came again to crouch beside me. He looked directly in my eyes, his yellow ones as hard to read as his colourless ones had been. He laid one long, cool hand along my cheek, and then gentled the hair back from my eyes.
"Tomorrow,"
he told me gravely,
"we shall be ourselves again, the fool and the bastard, or the white prophet and the catalyst, if you will. We will have to take up those lives, as little as we care for them, and fulfill all fate has decreed for us. But for here, for now, just between us two, and for no other reason save I am me, and you are you, I tell you this, I am glad. Glad that you are alive. To see you take breath puts the breath back in my lungs.
If there must be another, my fate is twined around. I am glad it is you."
He leaned forward then, and, for an instant, pressed his brow to mine. Then he breathed a heavy sigh and drew back from me.
"Go to sleep, boy,"
he said in a fair imitation of Chade's voice.
"Tomorrow comes early, and we've work to do."
He laughed unevenly.
"We've the world to save, you and I."
21. Confrontations. Diplomacy may very well be the art of manipulating secrets. What would any negotiation come to were not there secrets to either share or withhold? And this is as true of a marriage pact as it is of a trade agreement between kingdoms. Each side knows truly how much it is willing to surrender to the other to get what it wishes. It is in the manipulation of that secret knowledge that the hardest bargain is driven. There is no action that takes place between humans in which secrets do not play a part, whether it be a game of cards or the selling of a cow. The advantage is always to the one who is shrewder in what secret to reveal and when. King Shrewd was fond of saying that there was no greater advantage than to know your enemy's secret when he believed you ignorant of it. Perhaps that is the most powerful secret of all to possess. The days that followed were not days for me, but disjointed periods of wakefulness interspersed with wavery fever dreams. Either my brief talk with the fool had burned my last reserves, or I finally felt safe enough to surrender to my injury. Perhaps it was both. I lay on a bed near the fool's hearth and felt wretchedly dull, when I felt anything at all. Overheard conversations rattled against me. I slipped in and out of awareness of my own misery. But never far away, like a drum beating the tempo of my pain, was Verity's, "Come to me, come to me." Other voices came and went through the haze of my fever, but his was a constant.
"She believes you are the one she seeks. I believe it too. I think you should see her. She has come a long and weary way, seeking the White Prophet."
Geoffron's voice was low and reasonable. I heard the fool set down his rasp with a clack.
"Tell her she is mistaken, then. Tell her I am the White Toymaker. Tell her the White Prophet lives farther down the street, 5 doors down on the left."
"I will not make mock of her," Geoffron said seriously. "She has traveled a vast distance to seek you, and on the journey lost all but her life. Come, Holy One, she waits outside. Will not you talk to her, just for a bit?"
"Holy One," the fool snorted with disdain, "you have been reading too many old scrolls, as has she. No, Geoffron."
Then he sighed and relented.
"Tell her that I will walk with her 2 days hence, but not today."
"Very well."
Geoffron plainly did not approve.
"But there is another one with her, a minstrel. I don't think she will be put off as easily. I think she is seeking him."
"Ah, but no one knows he is here, save you, me, and the healer. He wishes to be left alone for a time while he heals."
I moved my mouth. I tried to